Hey everybody, this is the Brothers List number 45. I am Greg Soule. Let's see, what is this? April 29th. We're coming right up on the Mum. That's going to be shooting up pretty soon. Most of us are going to be there. Thomas Kurnak up there is going to be there. He's all the way from Slovakia.
Hello everybody, and yes, I will be there.
Excellent. And then Tom Smith summarily is protesting and won't be there.
Won't be there. Nope. Out of the armor.
It's sad, man. It's sad. Haven't seen you in a while. We've also got Mike Hammett all the way from Illinois.
I will be there as well. And how do you not have that on our agenda?
I don't know. Yeah, it's on there. It's on there.
Okay, I see it.
Yeah, it's down there under follow-up. So I'm going to go ahead and right off the bat apologize for my poor audio. For some reason, no matter what happens when I plug in a USB device in my laptop, it pretty much locks up. So I'm going to try and clean this up as best as possible. So hopefully there's not too much hum, hiss, and hopefully I don't have to put too much effort into it because I am absolutely lazy. So let's... Well,
if you think you're lazy with the videos, have you seen the videos that I upload to our page?
No. I take that back. I've watched a few.
I pretty much just cut at the very beginning when we start and cut at the very end, and that's all the editing I do.
Sounds solid to me. I don't know.
And you also cut my head out of the picture when I'm interviewing people, which is very annoying. When you're holding the camera. It's like a physical edit. It's like you tilt it downwards and to the left.
Now, to be fair, I corrected that like 4 shows ago. I got to stand.
And still love your mic. I'm just saying.
I heard Mike say that he was getting your best side when he did that. So.
I thought you would have been focusing on the bulge. Okay, moving swiftly on. Sorry, moving on.
All right. So let's jump back to the last one. A little bit of follow up. Some follow up. You can hear my children screaming. Sorry about that. Follow up being. The last one we were talking about a lot of the hardware that was announced at the EU MUM, and I got word that the MUPS is actually a dumb device. The monitoring LED will just light up when the battery's being used, so that's as intelligent as it is. Unfortunately, Thomas was getting me hyped up. I was getting excited thinking this thing had a router board built in, but...
Oh, I was so hyped up this one. I was already imagining all the countless situations where I could use it, and
and then when I first saw these notes get posted to our chat, I didn't know they came from somebody more official, and so I thought it was just viewer commentary. And so I saw MUPS, the dumb device. I'm like, all right, well, that's what we think of that device. I didn't realize they meant it's intelligence, not the concept.
Yeah.
I thought they were...
Yeah, for sure. Let's see what other corrections, follow-ups. We had the 1100 AH-X4, the one they're coming out. They're saying it has 3 switch groups, 1 through 5, 6 through... 10, 11 through 13, each with 2 5 gigabit full duplex line to CPU.
Yeah, that's an improvement on the original 1100 anyway, so.
Yeah. So it's saying each with 5 gigs, so ports 1 through 5, that would be each one could do a gig. Each with 2. Oh, God, they do commas, don't they, over there? Each with 2.5 gigs.
But it's a full duplex, so you could be talking about aggregate speed, so.
Yeah. All right, then. It's still better. Yeah, it's still an improvement.
Yeah.
That's basically meaning that it doesn't have anything in common with that previous architecture at all, because each of them had 1 gig to the switch groups, and then, you know, 11, 12, and 13, you know, I believe they all had their own dedicated 1 gig each.
And everyone was on its own... PHY that was integrated with the CPU, and then the other one was 12 and 13 were hideous, I suppose, would be one way to put it. So if you wanted to route it, you'd want to use, let's say, on 3 ports, you'd use one port from 1 to 5, one port from 6 to 10, and then 11. And then you'd stop. The other two ports were kind of fillers. Maybe for management or something like that.
Gotcha, gotcha. Let's see. They're saying that...
It wasn't entirely their fault. Like, I think it was the vendor not releasing good enough information on their hardware, so they couldn't actually optimize their kernel for those two ports. So when they were doing all the advancements on raw forwarding and routing performance, the only, I suppose, criticism I might have is lack of transparency on that. You know, that they didn't say, look, actually, you know, you'd have to have a couple of emails with them and they go, oh yeah, there's an issue there, you know, that kind of thing. But other than that, you know, it's not, in fairness, not everything's in your control, I suppose, when you're a hardware vendor.
Yeah, well, I mean, thinking about it too, where a lot of folks were using these were sort of on the edge of their networks as border routers, and most of the people I know deploying them didn't have a gig of internet, or they had no more than a gig of internet, so it worked out, I guess, for the most part.
Well, you see, it's where you see the, where I saw the issue is where people were using it, let's say, where they had a bit more bandwidth, but also where you were, you wouldn't see anywhere, you know, on a single TCP stream, you wouldn't see anywhere near the performance that, you know, you were seeing on the MikroTik test results. You know, like you'd peak out at around 200 megabits per second on a single stream of those ports, and then you'd, but then if you put four streams or eight streams or four streams, you'd get the 800 megs through it, you know, that kind of way. But if you had a single stream, you wouldn't, while on the others you would get through it. So it was it's just, I suppose, and it's actually one of the things that OpenBSD tried to get vendors to do, is release open documentation about their chips, so that the developers can actually, you know, write proper drivers and actually, you know, interact with the kernel in a much better sense. Like, they don't like using binary blobs, or in fact they don't, so they kind of write their own, they try and reverse engineer that. So but I think it's a kind of almost like a crusade they've been on, trying to get people to release better and more open drivers for network and hardware, for that reason, to improve stability, performance, and also stop running third-party binary crap in your kernel, you know. But anyway, sorry, moving on. Sorry.
No worries. They said the, what was that thing called, Thomas? The Woom or Woobum? That weird little wireless thing?
Yeah, I think it was Woobum, yeah.
Yeah, Woobum. The wireless out-of-band management dilly thing. They said they had one there. I guess they, I mean, it's small enough. You'd miss it if you weren't really looking for it. And they said the 60 gig stuff, they had a link running up there. Two towers, they said, inside the registration hall, 50, 60 meters apart, running one gig full dupe the whole time. So that's neato.
So I'd like to note that this is the first time that the Thomas has been wrong on the podcast.
And in life.
He said that it was not there, and it was.
I'm sorry, I apologize for the grave mistake there.
He must commit Sudoku. He's brought much shame to his family.
Okay, I shall commit to do one paper or one Sudoku riddle.
One then. Square of puzzles, yeah. I mean, that's what the Japanese people did. I used to think they would stab themselves, but apparently it was just math problems in these little squares. It's weird. Let's see. Tom, you put a little bit of stuff on here. OpenBSD, always beating that OpenBSD drum. Look at you getting, you're vibrating. You can't wait to talk about this stuff. You're the only guy I know that runs OpenBSD routing. I think it's because you're the only person crazy enough to get out there and do it.
But it was kind of, I suppose, a contrarian view. So I'm kind of not your average guy, I suppose, as anyone met me with a test.
It's one way of saying it.
I suppose they're less of the, I suppose they're just, for me, sometimes you just want something that will do some simple and reliable, you know, ultra reliability on it. So that's kind of why I've been using them. But and quite why I've been exploring it is for the cases where people just say, I wanted to do this very simple use scenario. Because in fairness, it is very difficult. It is much more difficult to deploy stuff on it. There's a learning curve on it.
How hard is it for your junior techs to jump in your boxes and do stuff?
Without runbooks, it's difficult. So, like, what we're trying to do, like, we hired another engineer there recently. So, kind of sat him down and I said, look, you're going to be learning MicroTik because we use it quite a bit. But we also want you to learn OpenBSD. And they're like, oh, deadly. And I said, yeah, well, wait till you see what you have to do to get things going. Be honest, the kind of thing about what I like about it is, well, it's a pain in the ass to get new services deployed, you know, I will say that. But then again, it's kind of like deployed. But like what Tom would have said about 2 years ago, I remember just about automation, Thomas Gerlach was saying about automation. And that is the kind of the key, is that once you develop a service and then you can stamp it out and you're not having to revisit routers, there's a value proposition there in that, you know, and that's kind of where we've been putting it in, where, let's say, other devices haven't been performing as stably as we'd like. And the results so far have been pretty positive. It's freeing up time. So we sacrificed an enormous amount of time in development and learning the product or the device. But I have to say, once you get something working, it seems to just churn away. Like I suppose, like some of those guys with the Dodge Rams and their Cummins diesel engine, you know, they just keep going. So that's for my American friends there.
So basically saying it's set it and forget it. You put it in place and it just runs. Takes just a little while to get there.
And but it took a while to get the, let's say, like, I'll give you an example. When we did a failover system, I think we had one working from MicroTik in about, you know, I think it was about an hour labbing it up. Now, that's not fair because, you know, we've used MicroTik extensively for that length of time. You know, but like the back of your hand. OpenBSD, it took a couple of, I think it was a couple of months of actual work to get working. But that said, I suppose I'm actually learning, so I'm studying for the BSDA and the BSDP, which is like certifications and stuff like that. So I'm banging the drum on the stability point of view, that once you set it up, it works. But it is an uphill battle. But I think it's one that they're unusual in that they don't try to make you want to use the product. They kind of go, if you want to use it, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, start coding yourself or start contributing, or at least have a good test. And it does force, and it also puts the control back in your hands. You know, when you have an open source product that's not working well, you have the power to actually change that, you know, that kind of way. And so far I haven't had to use the power. I've just had to learn the documentation and read and do, and it does what it says in the tin. So that's, but it is certainly a contrarian view. But it was just like he saw me at sometimes on the chats, on our private chat, just losing my head a few times and just being quite just when something wasn't working well for us. And this has been a great way for us just to, and it's a totally different way of approach. We could go to another vendor that's better at marketing, but maybe not as good tech side. And that's what we were looking for, was the technical brilliance, not the marketing essence. The UI, look, it's learning a new operating system. It's difficult. There's no way around that. The way we deal with the guys is just try and train them up. It's like myself and my colleague Michael Cotter, we were just chatting about it, and we said, what if you train up the guys and they leave? And they went, well, what happens if we don't train them and they stay? You know, yeah. Like, kind of, we were just having the crack. Like it was actually quoted from one of those LinkedIn type feeds that you see people writing the kind of nice little.
Yeah, I've heard that before. So
yeah,
I guess either way you're going to pay for it. Either you buy a commercial product that's easier to use, or you go BSD and you just have to pay your employees more. So one way or the other, you're going to pay for it, and you're just shooting for the stability aspect.
Yeah, exactly. And the automation, like, that's something that is absolutely key. Yeah.
Speaking of that automation, I see, because you said OpenBSD 6.1 was released, and in the notes in here you said it's got new Switch and Switch SDN controlled software, OpenFlow support as well, right?
I'll be honest with you, I haven't used that feature yet because it was released on, I think, the 17th of April. But right. I'm looking at using that. But I always thought OpenFlow was going to be just a fad, and
hasn't it disappeared?
Pardon?
It seems like it's all but disappeared. I haven't really heard anybody talking about it for a long time.
Yeah, no. Well, you see, the only thing I'd say is that when you go to let's say like of iNog or something like that, the bigger players seem to use it. Like when I say that, I mean the large.
AT&T types.
Not AT&T, more like this content, let's say content generation networks or content networks. But so it certainly disappeared from like the way I would have looked at it always was OpenFlow was a network or a software engineer's solution to a network engineer's problem, kind of way. So I didn't think too much of it. I suppose I'm looking at it from a point of view that I want to solve a particular problem with a design of my network, and it's to remove another type of device and replace them. And just if OpenFlow does it a better way for us, it makes it easier to manage, we'll do that. But at the moment, it's literally confined to a box that's installed on my table right here, which hasn't... It has to, so it's just to see it. But in fairness, it's been coming a while with OpenBSD. I think they had it, in the development branch for a while, and then they finally released it as production quality. So we'll have a quick look at it. When I was talking about automation, it was more like what Thomas Kernack would be into, which is Ansible or Puppet, that type of way, where you're actually, you have very consistent deployments for multiple, edited multiple files and all that type of stuff across the OS. But I will say that once you get used to this stuff, it is quite easy to navigate. It was a hell of a learning curve.
What an intro. So Justin Miller from Virginia just popped in.
Hi, Justin.
Oh, we're recording already?
Yeah.
I did not get that memo.
No, it's good. You just interrupted a diatribe from Tom, so we're good.
Right.
Any other highlights for OpenBSD?
8 minutes.
Yeah, in a tweet. If you had a tweet about OpenBSD closing words, what would it be?
BGP large community support. I suppose point to multipoint VXLAN support. And a binary patching utility, which you'd think with a really secure OS that they would have had that ages ago, but they used to do source patches, so if you had to do a change, now admittedly, on the releases, they usually have about a couple of patches for security or reliability, so they're quite small in the amount of patches they use. I think there was maybe 10 or 15 in the last release. So, but they have enough mitigations in there that we haven't really had to patch much in our experience, So hypervisor support, which is early days yet, and Raspberry Pi 3 support. So they do have Raspberry Pi 3 support, which I thought would never happen because of all the different blobs, but somehow they've managed to get around the binary firmware that was closed source on it, but they've managed to get around that somehow, so happy days. Actually, do any of you guys know much about the Optron A1100s, the ARM server stuff from AMD?
It's from AMD.
That'd probably be more an Andrew Thrift question.
Cool. Well, it seems to be something that might be worth a look at, because I was kind of going, oh, right. It's actually something I missed. I saw the Raspberry Pi 3 and I went, oh, nice, out of bad device on a site. Okay, sorry, moving on. Just tell me to shut up. Maybe. Thank you, guys.
It was only 10 minutes. That was pretty good for you.
Yeah, that was good. It was a good time. You can tell he wants to do another 10 minutes, too.
Maybe we'll do an encore here in a second. Let's see. Moving on down the list. Some interesting news, big news from us, is we're doing... it's going to be a thing. It's going to be a thing for sure. We're doing a routing panel at the Denver MUM. It's going to be May 25th and 26th. I think we're on day two. They give us an hour. So the idea being we had to kind of confine it to a sort of topic-ish. So we said routing. We're going to have Alex Hart. This is going to be his first kind of stage appearance. We're going to have Justin Miller. He's going to be on there, his first stage appearance. We're going to have JJ Boyd, mysterious JJ Boyd. He's still alive, still kicking. It's going to be me and Thomas Kernack as well. So I'll be the dumb guy in the room, and I'll play MC. And these other guys are going to be able to answer as many questions as possible. Hopefully we can get a lot of crowd interaction. The idea is it's basically an AMA. You ask us a question and we're gonna make up an answer on the spot. May be true, may not be true. You never quite know. I love this idea. I don't know why MikroTik hasn't done a panel of sorts before, right? But I think we've got a varied enough background of people where we can answer, probably at least two of us can answer any one question with sort of a different perspective on it, right? So I think that's very different and cool, and I want to bet that somebody's going to copy us next go around, but you guys just need to remember who innovated this one, who started this one. So
yeah, and actually I wouldn't call it an AMA, I'd call it an AMAAM.
All right, ask me anything about MikroTik.
Yes.
Yeah, well, this isn't a WISP conference, this is a MikroTik conference, so no, they obviously don't want people they don't want to ask you how to configure BGP and a Cisco device or anything like that. They wanted you to
to the audience of, you know, keep the questions confined to MikroTik.
Yeah, I would say make it questions that we can actually answer. Don't ask us when version 7 is going to come out. You know, don't ask us when they're going to release a router with 40 ports. It's like, I don't know. We're not part of MikroTik. We just use the products, and so ask us questions that are feasible for us to answer, hopefully.
Talk to technical Giannis or sales Giannis.
Or any of the other 60% of the population in Latvia that's named Giannis. It seems to be a very popular, it's like John over there. Let's see, you guys have anything else to say about that? I'm doing a presentation on troubleshooting. Wilson's going to be there as well. He'll be on the panel, yeah. I believe. He's doing a presentation on high availability best practices, I think. Hey, Kernack, what are you doing a presentation on? I assume you're doing one.
Yeah, doing an automation presentation. I actually presented this one in Europe already, but I figure, you know, US might also be a good crowd for an automation-based presentation. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Just be careful, because Miller might get at you for recycling slides.
Yeah, I expect at least 5% new slides for you.
That's the bar.
Other people
high.
Have more stricter requirements, as in at least 33% new slides.
Well, I think you can recycle once, but as soon as you go to the third round of recycling, that's when,
or the fifth time you're doing the same presentation, it's time to you know, it's find a new pony.
Yeah, I don't know, man. He plays Mary Had a Little Lamb really well. Like, practiced it a lot, so don't ride him too hard. Anybody else have anything to say about the Denver MUM?
I've seen some people on LinkedIn talking about it, so. You know, I made sure to plug our session there, even though I won't be there.
Yeah. Definitely a good, strong turnout. There's only a couple of us that aren't going to be able to make it. The Australians aren't going to be there. The Irish aren't going to be there. And for some reason, the Chicago guy. Yeah, I kind of lump in Australia, New Zealand.
Like, just drive there? I mean,
yeah. You know, just grab a canoe. It's all the same. But yeah, good turnout. So hopefully, you know, a lot of you guys will come up and shake our hands and make an acquaintance. I mean, that's how all of us idiots got together. We're just bumping into each other at the moment. So there you
go. My biggest regret.
One of them, for sure. let's see. Let's move right along. We have Unimus 0.3.3 is out. Give us the highlights, Thomas.
Mostly SSH key support. That's the big one with this release. And then also some, you know, quality of life features and some bug fixes. All right, so we are actually getting ready for 1.0.0 release. So, so 0.3.3, actually, if nothing major, you know, breaks and if no major bugs are discovered, is the last RC release. So hopefully sometimes in May or maybe June, we will release 1.0.0 and then that will be the production grade that we are completely happy with. We know it works, we know it's scalable, we know there is no performance issues, etc. release. So
killer. So if I'm an idiot and I don't know what SSH key support is, what does that mean?
So basically through SSH, you can, you know, when you SSH to a device, you need a username and password to authenticate against the device. And SSH keys are a more secure way of authentication. So you don't actually provide a password. You need the actual SSH key instead of your password. That would be the easy version.
Cool. Is that just going to be server-based, or is there any hardware that actually supports that?
Pretty much anything that's SSH supports SSH everything. Keys. All
right.
Just about everything. Of course, there is... Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, it's on a different topic, so you can wrap up yours.
So, yeah, most of the SSH servers out there, of course, support SSH keys, and most of your vendors do as well, so...
Cool, cool. All right, where are you going with that, Mike?
So, I did some Googling on the name Giannis in Latvia, and... trying to figure out how popular it actually is. And I'm still looking. I did find one site that did say about 5% of the population, or 5% of the boys are named Giannis. But interesting, given the context of why I started looking at that, is I came across an article in the Baltic Times entitled "Names are more than just Giannis." So apparently we're on the right track and that's pretty popular.
Alright, there you go. Let's see, scooting right along, Mike posted up a GPS sync NTP server that was fairly inexpensive. I know I use NTP for synchronizing the time on say servers and or network equipment. It's great for your syslog, so you can actually tell when an event happened. Make sure all that stuff is synchronized, but why do other people give a crap? Why would you actually go to the expense of putting a GPS sync server in your network?
Well, this would be nice if Frisch was here, because he actually bought one. So he would, I'm not sure of the advantage of this over just like a cell modem that does GPS. Like, I don't understand the difference.
I think, I want to say that I was reading up on this a while back, and I think the cell synchronization stuff, they're using some old cell protocol or something like that, and it's going to be depreciated pretty soon or something like that.
It's not just about that. It's also about connectivity, so what do you actually want to connect to your you know, atomic clock. And also about precision, because a lot of times, so for us or for our audience, it may be not that interesting, but for cable providers and for TV signal distribution and for DOCSIS systems, clocking and proper time synchronization is actually extremely important. And if you are doing TV, I don't know about US, but here in Slovakia, you actually have very strict laws and regulations about how time is distributed through TV, because it can actually be used for emergency services and for other things. So it depends if you want your atomic clock to be connected to DOCSIS infrastructure, to actual, you know, cable infrastructure, and etc. So it just depends what you need it for. You know, you need such a clock.
Yeah, so I think there's also security applications with like encryption things or tokens or things like that, where they have to be very precise and
So it depends on the application, right? We all know that crypto is very sensitive to proper time synchronization. Hmm. So it depends. If you have HSMs, you will definitely need extremely precise clocking, right? And HSMs are encryption modules, are hardware encryption modules, which you can use for... it's more of a server world thing, not a networking world thing, but yeah. It just proper time synchronization is important in so many applications. It depends for what application you need it, and then you need to buy a proper device for that.
Oh, yeah. I know I was running into this because we had a customer that was trying to install one in the data center, and they wanted to do a GPS sync module, and there's just limitations on how far you can go, whereas the cell ones, I mean, they work inside of a building, so it's very... Because GPS, you have to have line of sight to the sky, right? So it can hit those birds up there.
It operates at 1900 megahertz, so it'll accommodate some, or near 1900, I think it's like 1910 or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't go through a roof that has a steel superstructure with chillers and pumps, and somehow it doesn't make it through all that.
1575 megahertz and 1227. On this particular device, I lost the page. I did see that one difference between this and perhaps others is that this will actually use Cat5 to connect your GPS receiver sits outside and comes back in with Cat5, and it'll actually go up to, it says 200 meters of cable.
No, that's pretty good.
As opposed to, you know, some sort of RF cable.
About 650 feet. That's good. That's better than the other gear those people were trying to use. I think we beat that one to death. Let's see. Mike dug up, as he always does, some interesting stuff from the FCC. So whenever you're going to, from my understanding, release a wireless device, you have to file it with the FCC before they'll let you sell it here in the States. It has to get approved. So Mike picked up one from Microtech. It's an RB953GS5HNT US. Anything specifically interesting about that?
I think it's roughly the same as an existing product. I don't follow Microtech Wireless too much anymore, so I'm not sure which one that is. But this is they started making US variant because of new FCC rulings of firmware security and things like that. Hopefully this means that they'll eventually get things certified for DFS and whatnot, but I think this is just kind of an updated certification or maybe some slight hard ramification to work with current FCC regulations.
Cool. Does this look like it replaces kind of a SOHO model or more like an outdoor that's aggregating a lot of radios?
Let me look here.
Unless I am mistaken, if this is the same resale of the current ones on the market outside of US, it's actually a provider device, since it has, I think it was 3 gigabit ports and 2 SFPs and a triple chain 5 gigahertz wireless, and it's just a board. Right. So
nice.
It's for the provider segment.
Okay, cool. Moving right along, they also have the Ubiquiti U installer that got announced not too long ago, and so from what I understand, that's a little battery-packed PoE injector that's got a wireless card, I guess made for installers that can plug in on the end of the cable. It'll power up the radio, and you can configure it, I guess, with your phone or your laptop. Does that seem to be it?
As far as I'm aware.
Well, that's cute.
It's a little bit different than because they used to have the Air Gateway installer, which required an external power source. I think this one has a power source internal.
Just a built-in battery. That's cool.
So it looks like I see it in a store online, and yeah, it's an all-in-one device. It just has a USB in to recharge the battery, and then a PoE out, and some little lights on it. I'm guessing that the retail price will be $200.
But I remember, like, I don't know about you, but for the wireless ISP market, that'll be useful device. Like, the amount of gadgetry that, you know, lads carrying batteries and PoE inserters and all sorts of stuff,
yeah,
trying to light a dish on a roof is... So I think things like that are kind of nice to make engineers or installers' lives easier, you know? Because I think we've all had to try and solve that problem at one time or another, either through scheduled maintenance or in an emergency situation. You're like, oh, you know, you're trying to fashion something together from the back of your truck or something like that, you know?
So yeah. I took, so I have a cordless drill set from Ryobi, and I took the flashlight because nobody ever uses that. And I just hooked that up to a PoE injector, and it pops in 18 volts. That's what I use.
Thanks.
Let's see, moving right along. This is kind of wider news outside of the West Network, but Riverbed just picked up Xeris. I believe Xeris used to do, what was their claim to fame? I think they had access points that you could kind of plug in a whole bunch of radios, and I think they were trying to really do the high-density market. I think they also have, I want to say, a switch line of some sort that actually kind of did aggregation for those things. Does that sound right?
I'm not sure on the switching aspect, but yet, you know, they were a company that seemed to just kind of start with high, you know, in mind when they started the company, and they've yeah, like I think you can put up to like 18 separate radios into one radio enclosure. You could have less, but you could put up to 18, and it seemed almost as if it would, you know, you have some sort of smart antenna array thing. You come into smaller sectors as you put more radios in. I'm speculating. It's been years since I read.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I researched them.
But, you know, they seem to be somebody that, you know, do that high-density stuff pretty good. And I think it's proven to them. Somebody bought Ruckus, so that's what's left. It's yours.
Damn. Sounds like Riverbed wants to be a networking company. You know, kind of the, I guess everybody knows Riverbed as the WAN accelerator, right? So if you had multiple sites, it would help your throughput in there. I'm guessing by doing some, maybe some dedupe or some TCP modifications or something like that, or maybe some immediate acknowledgments to kind of help out on window sizing at distance, something like that. And now they're trying to, it sounds like, kind of own the branch edge, maybe something to that effect, right? You have the wireless built in with your WAN acceleration and maybe some SD-WAN sort of thing in there. I guess they're going to own that portion of the market, or attempt to anyway. The only thing I know anybody using Riverbeds for is the WAN acceleration, and I haven't seen too many of those hit the data center for a while, so maybe this is a Hail Mary trying to become relevant again. I don't know. Do you guys know of any people really using the Riverbed stuff? No? Not really your bag? All right. Let's see.
That's not my bag, baby.
It's not really mine either, for the most part. Somebody added in here that NetXMS added some approved support for IgniteNet, Juniper, Extreme. It's Mike. It's Mike. HP Enterprise, Nexmo, SMS Eagle, and My Mobile API. I guess that was in a few of the most recent updates. But, Thomas is the resident NetXMS expert. You have any comment on that?
No, I could talk for hours.
And yet you don't.
There's been some really good stuff happening on the NetXMS front. Yeah, mainly with the new drivers for devices, and also particularly with tunnels. So historically, NetXMS only supported server to agent connections. And there's many reasons for this, and you know, it's a long debate which I don't want to get into, but the point is that finally now, since the last major release, actually agent to server connections are supported now through tunnels. So agent actually creates a connection to the server, creates a tunnel, and everything gets routed inside of the tunnel. And why this was a problem before is because NetXMS is so feature rich. NetXMS agent is not just a simple thing that provides some metrics from the collected OS. It provides many more features, and that's why it was a problem. But now they actually implemented SSL tunnels. So that's a very nice new feature, and it works based on certificates, and you have a certificate manager in the server and all of that. So it's of course all based on industry standard open source, you know, things. So it's nice and secure. And yeah, so that is out. Then of course all the new drivers specifically for IgniteNet wireless. It was a quite a bit of problem to monitor Ignite through NetXMS because, as is sadly the standard in the industry, is that the vendors don't actually expose proper stuff through SNMP, and it was the same with Ignite actually. They did an extremely strange thing and only exposed about half of interface table. And NetXMS had a problem with this because it started reading the interface table, and then suddenly the device didn't, you know, it responded to some OIDs and some not. And NetXMS thought that was an issue with the SNMP agent on the device. So they had to do some custom implementation and custom driver to fix that. And so that's also now working and supported.
Pass this along to your contacts there. If you're having problems with IgniteNet, let me know. I know a guy there. I'll beat him up.
Mike knows a guy that knows a guy that can kill a guy. That's interesting. Yeah, and the NetXMS guys, I mean, it is an open source project, but they also, I mean, they're guns for hire, right? So if you're going to pay them to take care of something, they're going to put more focus on that, right? So, because I remember a long time ago, you teased me blatantly about some kind of an app store where you could download like templates for different devices, and then they kept getting these lucrative contracts from governments and other places, so it kept getting put on the back burner. Did that ever get completed or whatever?
It's actually still being worked on, just slowly, because, you know, paid customer development takes precedence.
Yeah, right.
But now, Greg, you can blame Thrift for some of that, because I believe Thrift's company has gone with NetXMS for some things and made some requests as a part of their development, and you can blame him for that.
I never blame a guy with that good a hair. You just can't do it. Let's see. I've got something else on the list here. Right along, it says IoT, Sigfox, and US. I guess that's Internet of Things. What is Sigfox? Who added this? I have no idea what this is.
If you don't know what it is, I'm probably the one that added it.
All right, what is it?
So, IoT, Internet of Things, it is lots of buzzwords about things that mean a lot as buzzwords go. There are a couple companies actually building IoT-based networks. Sigfox is one of them. They're a French company I thought it wasn't much of anything, but apparently on Facebook there's a couple people that actually have some Sigfox infrastructure on their towers and plug into their network, and and actually I went to call Justin Wilson about it because I saw that he had a common contact in LinkedIn, and he talked to them quite a bit actually on Friday. And of course they wouldn't tell him what they were doing or who they were doing it with. I suppose sort of like a teenager being accused by their parent, wondering what they're doing at night and refused to answer. It's a live network in the United States that runs in the 900 megahertz band. I believe New Zealand it's running at like 860 megahertz. But they're talking to sounds like they want to talk to vehicles and pull information out of vehicles live. Not so much like, your car, but like a trucking company. Real time stats from the truck, so on. And they actually have a network map on their website that I can't get to work right now. But they are in I think they're in a couple dozen different countries now, and actually they're deployed in the Chicago area, so I'm going to try to get involved with them. That's definitely an opportunity, I think, out there for WISPs, not so much in build health, but somebody who wants to get out there and, you know, build things. You know, they need places to put towers and, you know, upstream connectivity. So people like that would be a good partner, I think.
Interesting. All right. Well, you get a little bit more information, you'll have to fill us in, as I'm sure you will do. Moving on down the list, I believe this was some stuff we added from last week because we just had too much to cover, and so we kind of cut it at the hour mark, but we still have a little bit left, even with Tom's rant. We have Australia mandatory metadata collection. I'm not sure who put that in there. Was that you, Thomas?
Yeah, that's actually mine.
I thought it might be. But that's interesting. Tell us a little bit more about it.
So what happened is that earlier this month, is it April? So I think it was earlier this month, yes. In Australia, the legislature went into action that forces ISPs and internet providers to collect metadata on all of the traffic that you actually, you know, run over the ISP. And this has caused quite a bit of uproar, especially from, you know, human rights groups and everything, because it's basically fully unregulated metadata connection collection, and ISPs are required to submit the data to the government. And a few friends that I have in Australia notified me about this, and actually one of them bought a Microtik router immediately when this went live, and, you know, configured a few VPNs to get around this. But it's an interesting issue that, you know, it's a mandatory non-regulated metadata collection from all content and internet providers, which is not setting a very good precedent, I would say.
So metadata as in websites people are browsing to, things like that.
Type thing, like, is that what they're looking for?
Full packet headers on everything.
Okay, so full packet headers. That's going to be source to destination information. Is it anonymized? So is it just more or less statistical, or is it actually able to be tracked back to the individual?
Yeah, it's exactly meant for tracking back to individuals. So if a government wants to know who did something and when, you know, they simply ask. There is no and I might be wrong here because I haven't studied the laws, of course. If the government wants to know what you are doing, there is no court order needed. There is no nothing because the data is submitted by the ISPs and they just know.
That's interesting. So be able to track your information, what you're doing, and back to the person themselves. Wasn't Australia the one that has like the porn filter on their national?
Yeah, a lot of things are actually blocked in Australia. Yeah, the most popular torrent trackers and torrent indexers, and yeah.
Well, I mean, it's as funny as landmass big as Australia is. I think, what is there, only like 20 million people or something like that, so it's the size of a major American city, you know, like population wise so it, as crazy as it sounds that they would affect something nutty like this, you have to remember that people wise they're so small, so you can't actually do
it's
crazy
not about the number of people, right? It's about being because this is, of course, the film industry and the rights holders industry and the, you know, IP owners industry pushing laws on an entire country, and this is actually where it came from. So these laws originally came from the IP holders and rights holders industry. And it doesn't matter the number of people. What matters is that such a breach in privacy can be forced onto a whole country and go through whole laws and sanctified without, you know, there is no checklist, there is no court orders, there is...
Yeah. People. To me, it's not necessarily the number of people. It's how could legislation like this be passed? And for me, you know, because I had thought about this too, like their gun laws where, you know, they could widespread after... You know, really one major event. There was a mass shooting or whatever over there, and then they shortly thereafter passed legislation to, you know, really tighten gun laws. It was pretty much a buyback from the entire country. And so looking at how could you actually affect a change like that, because we could never do that here in the States. You know, something as controversial as that would never happen here in the U.S. And I think it's just we have too many people, and the fact that we're so spread out that if you go state to state, you might as well be in a different country. You know, and so the morality, the sense of community is different here in, say, Texas versus New York or San Francisco, you know, over in California.
It almost happens with SOPA, you know, in the US, and only that guy who ended up unfortunately committing suicide, where the government kind of seemed to go after him. I forget his name, but he invented RSS feeds or was the developer behind it. There's actually a Netflix video about him. Just basically what they say is that, you know, and the dangerous thing about what Thomas Kernick's saying is that you can retroactively, so someone pisses off someone, and then you can go back through all the records and find something to prosecute them on. So it's the widespread intelligence gathering and then the retroactive application of an investigative powers without probable cause. So they piss you off, you go back through their whole history, find something that you can prosecute them on, and then take them down.
Gotcha. So all you have to do is come up with some sort of probable cause, and then every bit of information they've ever produced, you can go back and prosecute them on that? So
probably, as I said, I haven't studied this particular Australian law that passed, but here you wouldn't even have to have probable cause because you don't require a court order.
Yeah. Right. So if they had some kind of automated system that was searching for some specific content, and it could key in, and then an investigation would kick off, and then boom, whatever.
Not just that, but it's not as simple in the digital age, right? If something originates from your IP address, it doesn't mean it was... It really doesn't. You might have had a virus, your network might have been compromised, you might have had open Wi-Fi, you just might have had a visitor that came in, you know, or somebody with a laptop stayed outside your house, you know, cracked
That's
your
true from
Wi-Fi.
A technical perspective, but the law hasn't caught up.
Well, I think here in the U.S. we've had some court cases that somewhat recently ruled an IP is not a person.
In local, yeah. Or it's not national, I don't think.
Well, so you can always cite a case.
You can see how it can be actually very controversial if you do mass metadata collection on based on IP addresses and try to identify individuals. You know, it's
is that
in
like
Germany
saying...
you have to make sure your Wi-Fi has a password on it, and when you get your internet, you know, you sign something to that effect so that you
but
can't claim
that doesn't work
that kind
either.
Of thing.
I mean, via the networking guys, how hard is it to break into a Wi-Fi? It's not hard. None of the private Wi-Fi, even VPA2, is very easy to break into if the password is not something crazy. You know, you have the authentication attacks, then you do dictionary attacks. It's not that hard. If somebody really wants to break into your Wi-Fi, all it requires is time and computational power, which is really easy to come by these days.
Well, and then they don't have to do that either. They could spoof. If they, you know, compromise the modem, they could be, you know, just sniffing all of the packets on the cable modem, for instance, you know, and the cable is supposed to only pass what's yours, but if you compromise the cable modem, you know, you could pretend you're anybody.
Absolutely. Like the Vault 7 thing where, you know, once you get root access to a device, you can actually proxy, you can generate packets and all that type of stuff. So you can actually frame someone. No, look, it's bad precedent because rather than going, you're doing mass data collection rather than targeted data collection. Which you know, there's a massive difference. And like what Thomas says, it is coming from recording rights and the intellectual property rights of people. And the problem is the contagion from that into your privacy and other and human rights, like being able to research and access pertinent information. It's a dangerous step towards kind of Big Brother 1984, George Orwell stuff.
Well, I mean, I think too, you know, it's dangerous from a lot of aspects, right? So not just prosecution, but think about too, that information's being held by the government, right? And so it's in some database somewhere that somebody with power will be able to search. So I don't know, say for example, they wanted to get something done in another district. Well, they just dig up a little dirt on, you know, the candidate that controls that district. And then once you have that leverage, you can do whatever you want, right? So it's not necessarily prosecution, but it could be absolute control over any political party.
Yeah.
Or the database can be compromised.
Yeah.
Somebody can steal the database.
Yeah, if that thing spills out. And nothing is safe, right? Somebody asked me, it was a high school kid the other day, I was giving a tour to her. So they said, well, how do you keep your computer from getting hacked? And I said, you unplug it and you put it in a closet. You know, that's the only way you can completely make sure anything's safe. And then I guess you could beat it with a hammer and then burn it in a fire. That's about the only thing you could do. So yeah. If there's a will, there's a way. Somebody can get that information and it can be exploited in the wrong way. Do I think, I don't know, right? It's a lot of times you see that kind of stuff reactionary, right? So something catastrophic happens. So, you know, some guys, I don't want to get into it, but you know, something bad happens and then people have a knee-jerk reaction to that thing. But does this feel like a knee-jerk reaction to something that happened in Australia that I guess I just don't keep up a lot with them.
No, it's just being forced by the industry.
That's interesting.
As in the rights holder industry.
I don't know.
I might be wrong as well. So if somebody knows more about this, please correct me and correct all of us. But that's the information that I have.
What a bag of dicks.
There you go. I don't know, man. That stuff worries me. It scares me. I try and think of all angles, right? You know, just be devil's advocate and why you would do these things and what purpose it could serve. And I guess, theoretically, there's good in everything, right? Good and bad sides. You know, it could stop some kind of terror attack. But then again, we just spit out, you know, several show-stopping things that could happen because of it. It's fairly frightening. I'm against giving absolute control over to any government. I really have an authoritarian problem when you get down to the core of it. I think that's my issue.
So someone in Texas
has an authoritarian problem? Yeah, man, born and raised. I guess it's in my DNA and my heritage. I can't help it. I'm not a crazy gun nut or anything like that, though. Just kind of, you know, a regular nut in general. We have some other security stuff on here now that we beat the hell out of that one. New Chrome considers start SSL root certs as untrusted. Is that, well, didn't, who was it? Symantec. Symantec got in trouble by Google not too long ago as well, right? Because they issued, I think, 30,000 or 80,000.
They originally thought it was in the low thousands, and then they came out and was like, yeah, it's 30,000
that
we issued.
Yeah, improperly issued certificates. So those guys are getting smacked down pretty hard by Google.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine Google coming after a big cert trust.
They're
like
actually
that.
Google's not going to trust any of those certs after a while for more than 6 months. So the most you'll be able to get from those guys is a 6-month cert.
Yeah. So it's in effect going to cripple anybody attempting to use.
Well, rightly so. They screwed up. I mean, everyone's putting your trust in you in those guys to do that correctly, and you screw up, you don't get the right anymore.
Yeah,
but I think the industry's moving to 90-day certs anyways. It's a lot safer.
Who was it?
There's no real way of revoking certs once they get out, so they're only good for 90 days, and automation's good enough to keep renewing them, then it doesn't really matter. Well,
The GRC guy, the Security Now podcast,
Steve Gibson,
yeah, he actually had some good information on a lot of that, and I think he said these guys really need to lock their infrastructure down, do the right thing, because they basically have been given a license to print money, right?
Yeah.
They hand out a few bits that cost them nothing, and you know they get actual cash for it, so they're literally printing money doing nothing. So.
Unless it's an EV cert, then there is someone doing something, supposedly. So.
Mm. Yeah, okay. But like, let's say the non-EV ones where it's literally just, oh, it came from this email address, gmail.com. Oh, he must be a gmail.com administrator.
I don't know why you would go for a cert from those guys for anything but an EV these days, or buy anything but an EV, because you can use Let's Encrypt to get just that bare minimum of encryption.
So it's not actually that simple. And why I particularly find like this, you know, this is not wrong. If there really was some wrongdoing at start SSL, then, you know, they need to fix it. But the problem with Let's Encrypt is, and we use Let's Encrypt extensively, actually. All our websites are Let's Encrypt. But the problem with Let's Encrypt is that for services which don't let you use CertBot, which is the utility from Let's Encrypt that issues and renews certs, the 90-day certs are actually really painful. Just imagine, you know, having a MikroTik SSTP server that you need to actually...
So if everything supported it, then your argument, this particular but point, would not be...
Yeah, if I was able to run CertBot on everything, but it's not possible, right? Because on embedded
I mean,
devices.
It might be very, very soon. You might start seeing it.
Yeah, you send in a support ticket to MikroTik.
Then yes, yeah. So I mean, I've got problems with it. I mean, I run CN Maestro, and you can't. They don't even have instructions on how to replace the cert for that. And then you run Unify Server. I mean, that's a pain in the butt to replace with a Let's Encrypt cert. I mean, I do it, but you know, there's all kinds of services that have problems with that. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have to go and buy a $20 cert from, you know, namecheap.com or whatever to get your 3-year cert for some embedded device or something that's in the ass to use Let's Encrypt on. I'm just saying if everything was automated, then the 90-day cert is the way to go, because you're not going to get this problem with start SSL issuing certs for your bank. You know, so... And if that stuff does happen, and it should only be valid for 90 days.
Yeah.
So the problem actually is that it's a printing money problem, right? And for me, currently there is only 2-3 ways to get certs, which is start SSL and Let's Encrypt, right? If you want the actual free, you know, level 1 certificate that, you know, you don't do EV, you don't do anything. You have no other choice. And with the way that every, you know, all services are moving to SSL now, like every single service. And if you count the number of those little $20 certs that you need, it's now in, you know, 2017, it's not a trivial amount of money anymore if you want to really secure all of your services properly. And so, yes, you have two options, right? You have Let's Encrypt, which we talked about, has obvious limitations on devices where you can run CertBot. And then you had Start SSL. So we actually ourselves were using a lot of Start SSL, the free cheap certificates, on a lot of our services. And yes, now I have to figure out how to fix that, because new Chrome just won't work with it anymore.
That's interesting. What's the rationale? Why aren't they supporting it anymore?
So Chrome and Mozilla simply removed the Start SSL CA from their trust store, which means that all certificates issued by Start SSL now show as invalid in all of your major browsers.
Nice.
And of course, there were some warnings before when Chrome said they were going to do it, but honestly, who knew? Like, you know. I found out when all of our website, all of our services using Start SSL certs started, showing red pop-ups in the browser. And it's just I am not saying it's not the right thing to do. Obviously, if they were issuing certs for a bank and for other things, it's obviously, not what they should be doing, and they should be punished for that. I'm just saying that the overall state of the cert industry, so to speak, is very. I'm just not happy at the state of this currently.
Interesting. So another one that I think is a Thomas one is the Turkey blocks Wikipedia, sacks another 4,000 officials.
Yeah, no, so I added that one in. It's just Turkey seems to be moving backwards under Tayyip Erdogan, and they recently just shows you people will vote badly and giving him another power, more powers, executive, making it an executive presidency, like making Turkey an executive presidency rather than a parliamentary democracy, like so more like the states or France, as opposed to, and having control to appoint court officials and stuff like that. But just Turkey seems to be going backwards, and they like blocking. So they used to be a lot more, I think, secular. They just seem to be more urging towards a kind of, I won't say a theocracy or anything like that, but they certainly seem to have this moral brigade and this type of crack going on. And just Tayyip Erdogan seems to be able to control quite a bit in the country at the minute since the coup, which you wonder whether it was staged or not, you know, as in was it just allowed happen when it was going to fail and then used it as an excuse to crack down. It was just a pity because they were an EU candidate country, and I think they're just going further and further away from that. I think Turkey's going to be in for dark days ahead, you know, when you're blocking Wikipedia from your citizens. What's next, you know? So sorry for the people of Turkey.
Yeah, it perplexes me, kind of internet censorship, how that's allowed in these countries and things like that. But I mean, obviously it serves their purposes, so it makes sense. I guess from that perspective, I'm trying to control the people, so I control the flow of information as best I can.
He can't control us, though. In your face!
Thank you, sir.
I'm the angry Irishman.
Yeah, there he is. Yeah, that's interesting.
No, well,
it's not interesting. It's just, I don't know. It's a very different way of thinking, and it perplexes me how they can get away with that. And I guess more people just need to understand what VPNs are and how they operate.
Yeah.
That's the best I can say about that.
SSL VPN, so that way it looks like you're just doing web traffic and not, you know, PPTP or something.
Yeah, well, PPTP can be cracked fairly easily.
It just looks like noise on port 443. Still look like web traffic.
Yeah.
Let's see.
PPTP would be enough to get around the block, but not for the privacy side of things.
yeah. Like, if it's, I mean, if you're in a unfriendly country doing unfriendly things, I would use something a little bit stronger than PPTP to try and get, you know, I mean, yeah, I guess it serves a purpose, but that technology's been depreciated for years. It really is. You know, I guess if you're at a hotel and you're trying to just keep average schmucks from listening to what you're doing or getting past their Netflix block, then PPTP is probably great for that, right? It doesn't consume many resources on your client or on the router itself. But if you're trying to go for security, I would try and harden that up a bit. What do you guys use most of the time? Is it L2TP, or I heard Thomas talking about SSTP. Is that what you guys have transitioned to for the most part?
So we actually switched, I think we talked about it at the last podcast, we actually switched to using IPsec Xout almost exclusively through all of our services. And I mentioned that it works great on MikroTik for us. It's supported across just about any client natively, except Windows, but then you have Shrew, which is a free, you know, free VPN client, which works great as well. But before we used to do a lot of L2TP IPsec. We used to have a huge L2TP IPsec networks, and all our clients had that, but now we switched to Xout. And if everything else fails, of course, there is SSTP, which is really nice that it's SSL, but then you get into TCP inside TCP congestion. So if you really want performance and good TCP windowing and avoiding all those issues, then, you know, something UDP-based or pure IPsec-based is much better.
Gotcha. Cool. One more thing on the list. I've got Fios Gig. Is that, Mike, did you put that on there?
No, I put that on there.
Miller?
Fios has got big service in our area now. It's like 960 down and 880 up.
Consistent
for
with the price line.
$70 a month.
Wow. How's that doing?
AT&T has about that in a lot of my WISP area.
Yeah. They call it gig, but it's not gig. It's only 880 up. I mean, it's false advertising. Let's get on the bandwagon. Where's
There's
the pitchforks?
There's an asterisk that says up to, and it depends on where you're at. You know what I think is so funny? I've had this conversation with a lot of people. Is it different giving somebody 100 megs versus a gig? In my opinion, it's really not, because if you have 15 megs, that's going to, for 95% of the population, that's going to give you everything you want. You're going to be able to stream multiple Netflix sessions or YouTube.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Greg, but a single 4K Netflix stream is 18 megabits.
I know, but I don't know very many people that are actually running 4K Netflix streams. It's usually they're watching them on small devices, and their kids are doing it on mobile, things like that, right?
Yeah.
So it's fairly... I'm just saying, like, kind of on
so
average, it's not necessarily...
We've got fairly large buildings, and one of the buildings that we have is right on our dark fiber. So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
got basically 10 gig connectivity to everything we peer give. And I've uncapped the property for weeks at a time just to see, like, any change in the usage graph there for the whole property? And it's not enough to really
right. It's
matter.
I mean, it doesn't matter how much bandwidth you get. You're not going to change your habits for the most part.
Yeah,
right?
No.
So
I mean, most people are still streaming Netflix. They're still streaming Hulu. They're, you know, it's just the people that use, that download or have some kind of chain set up to torrent TV shows automatically. And then it's like, they do it and they're done and that's it. And they're not, to really saturate a huge pipe like that, you got to be reselling it or something like that.
I see some WISPs that are still, you know, really concerned about, you know, peer-to-peer traffic. You know, I know a guy that.
Yeah, it's.
It's just, really? It's just, you know, you got to block peer-to-peer. I'm like, who does that? Like, I mean,
yeah, no, I mean, we don't block that.
There's still a little bit of, you know, use of, but like, you know, you go back 5 or 10 years ago, and yeah, you know, peer-to-peer is a big thing because there was no legitimate source of content.
It was bigger than most of our pipes is what the problem was. Like, it was a problem back in 2009 when we had, you know, 100 megs and people were touring through that. So...
Yeah, with the advent of Netflix and Hulu and all the streaming services, I've seen our torrent traffic go way down.
Yeah.
Also, Netflix has it's very adaptive, the algorithm, you know. It uses as much bandwidth as you give it, almost. And then, but if you, you know, cap it, I've seen it, let's say, for smaller wireless ISPs, where if they cap the bandwidth, the rate adapts, you know, whatever way the compression or the streaming works, it actually still has a pretty good picture, but and it's not pausing.
It's pretty easy to
actually cap Netflix. In fact, we tried to tell them, is there any, can you see any problems on our network with Netflix? And they're actually pretty good. Like, they'll say, no, we're not seeing any irregularities or any weird stuff. So I've actually emailed, like, the peering Netflix lads and just said, we don't seem to be using you that much on the peering. Is there any issue there? They're like, no, it's just, you know, maybe the user base aren't using Netflix as much, but it's been growing quite considerably on our network for the past few years, you know, but just when it was, you know, when you see a sudden drop, you're like, is there some issue? Did they change something? Is a problem on your network? If you want to get information from them, just, you don't want to be, you know, usually some customers just wait a month and they're absolutely insanely pissed off with you because Netflix has to be working properly. And then you're like, and it has to be working for a month. And you're like, well, you only told me now, so give me a break. But just when we see the graphs, you're like, oh, that's a drop, you know. The only provider really that I see, and where if Google sometimes move off the exchange from time to time, that's a massive swing in traffic. Like, I'd say Google are well over half of our traffic.
Yeah, you can tell how much peer-to-peer you have by looking at your peering and then your transit links. Because you're not peering with any of the other ISPs like Verizon and Comcast. They don't peer. So you got your content, and then you've got your transit pipes for that stuff.
Yeah. And like, it was just seeing like, so, I remember meeting just the IDOC, a few of the Google peering engineers, and I was saying, guys, you sometimes scare us to just see the traffic, you know, they just obviously are doing maintenance, they shut down the, they're not advertising as many prefixes into us. And you just see a massive drop of traffic, and you're like, this is something I said, this is something I did, you know. It just moves over, and then, you know, after a few hours, it just comes back, and you're like, oh, okay, they're not pissed off at me, I haven't annoyed them or anything, like, but it is great, like, it's funny that when you're on the exchanges, you see all that type of behavior, you know, you're like, oh, the lads must be doing maintenance, oh, they're doing an upgrade, and, you know, you're pulling it from London, let's say, rather than Dublin. And then it comes back to Dublin, and you're like, yay. So, sorry.
No, cool.
Sorry, my American friends who might be 1,000 miles away from the nearest Google Pop.
Yeah, and it's just, well, I mean, kind of going back to the Fios gig, it's all marketing, right? People aren't going to change their habits. Nothing's going to adjust. But how do you overcome that?
I pay $50 for 150 right now. I'm good. That for $20 more a month, and there's no, you know, that's the price of it. Mine is 50 right now. It's going to go up as soon as these discounts expire. So I'm going to try to get on that.
You're jumping in on it.
I'm jumping in on that, man. So
4K.
It's it's another thing is that realistically you will not be able to, even if you could actually get that gig down to the customer, you will not be able to pull content at a gig. It's even if you wanted, at least not from my experience, not here in Europe. It's very hard to actually find, you know, CDNs and servers where you can actually pull content at a gig.
Yeah. I know I've done some stuff like, I'm doing a Lynda course right now, and since I got bought by Microsoft, they don't use Google Docs anymore, which I hate because I loved the collaboration part of Google Docs and that stuff anyway. So I have to sign into yet another service, and so I have to use Box.com, which is the Microsoft's version of Dropbox or whatever, and I pulled a file, and I was getting, I don't know, 400 megabits a second with that. So it was, that's pretty good, but it was that fast and then done. So I would have been just as fine if it took 4 seconds instead of 1 second. You know what I mean? It makes, I don't know, just at the quality of networks these days, that little difference means nothing to me. But then again, I'm an informed consumer, and how many other people out in the real world can say that they understand it the way we do?
But Google actually said that they released some research where they delayed the searches by half a second. Just put in a delay just to see how it affects user behavior. This was just in terms of displaying the results. And they noticed that people, if the searches were much quicker, people would use it more and more kind of indiscriminately. And then they noticed that people were kind of being more discerning when it was slightly slower. They were actually thinking about what they were searching a little bit more. And then they sped it back up again, and it took a while for the user behavior to actually recover and the level of searches that were was fast. So it's kind of unusual. I suppose if you're doing I hate saying it, but cloud storage, you know, like where your files are in the clouds, it's something that we haven't necessarily gotten on the bandwagon. You know, we use our email and all that. That's all cloud-based. But in terms of just, you know, you're, like what you were saying, your docs, if that's obviously a use case where the gig would help, or if you've multiple people in your organization who are uploading and downloading files, I think that's obviously, like, you're effectively getting LAN speed internet connectivity, which is pretty nice. So I think in that case, it might be a use case for like Justin Miller's area, you know, small businesses, where they might be using 365, you know, Microsoft or Google, not Google Docs, but, you know, where you're actually uploading big files all the time.
I guess I was thinking from just kind of a user at their house sort of perspective. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. What were you going to say, Thomas?
So there is a difference. There is a big difference between having some download speed, and there is a big difference by having your searches delayed by half a second. And yeah. And the difference is, and there is also a bunch of research on this, that if you are doing a continuous task, a continuous flow of work, actually any delay higher than 200 milliseconds to our brain, it feels like there is a pause, there is a breakage in that continuous flow of the task that you are doing.
Yeah.
So that's why Google, you know, when you are searching for something, it's a continuous flow task, but that's very different to when you are downloading a file, which is not a continuous flow. It's just, oh, I want this file and I'm prepared to wait for it because I know it's going to download. So
yeah.
You know, that's a speed versus latency.
Yeah, well, there, to that end too, I being in a data center and having to convince people that it's a good idea to put your equipment in a data center, part of that is remote desktop, right? So doing thin clients and things like that. And part of that research too says, yeah, if you have 200 milliseconds plus of latency between you and your thin client, it's perceptible to people and it becomes annoying. And right, so one of the main things is when an IT infrastructure shifts to a thin client, they're already going to have people bitching, right? They're already going to be upset. So if you introduce this amount of latency as well, it's usually a deal breaker. So if you can have it 100 milliseconds or less, you're usually super solid to do sort of a thin, you know, and that's just sending your keyboard clicks and whatever and then waiting for that information to come back, right? So there is truly like psychological difference between latency of you inputting something and then waiting for it to come back versus how fast you can download something.
But if you look at it, let's say if you're looking at files or working on a file server on a LAN, I would consider that a continuous process. If you're, oh, I need to check this file, I need to open this file, let's say it's a CAD file or something like that. If you're doing it over the internet, we're trained that it's an operation in itself. While if you have that like speed, you know, it would become a continuous flow. That was the kind of point I was trying to make, is that if you have that type of speed, that accessing files becomes more like a continuous activity, Tom, you know?
Yeah, that's so a crazy future to think we're going to be accessing CAD files over the internet like that. Or like some
parts in assembly and spin it around, job done. Like, you know, it's mad the way things
are. Or like geological information, because some of those guys' maps are just astronomically huge.
I've got tons of GIS. I mean, I've hundreds. I see probably 100 gigs or more of GIS information.
Yeah, this stuff's crazy. It gets out of hand pretty quick. Let's see. We beat the hell out of that one too. Do you guys have any anything else off the top of your head? Or are you ready to put a bow on it? We're at about an hour and 20.
You talk about BSD again. I don't know for sure.
It's not. I thought you were going to do just like a podcast all on your own, just talk about OpenBSD. I thought that was the thing.
We'll do that someday.
Oh, it's not on the list. Here we go. I'll add it to our list. OpenBSD. I just added it to our Google Docs right now.
Yeah, or white noise, as we'll call it. let's put a bow on this one. Thomas Kernak in Slovakia. If people want to get a hold of you on the interwebs, how do they do that?
So as always, I'm pretty easy to find. Just Google for me, and you can find me, you know, Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, whatever you have. Yeah, I'm fairly easy to find. And
find him on unimus.net. He's got a good backup there.
Check us out at Unimus, yeah.
So did you say that you're pretty and easy to find?
Oh yeah,
you could have stopped it easy. There you are. Let's see, Tom Smith. If people want to find you out there on the big bad internet, how do they do that?
Hit me on LinkedIn, Skype, Facebook, email, my cell number. Actually, I have to give a shout out to JT and RF Elements, who actually used my postal address and didn't send me a slab of beer, but a pallet load of beer, which I would say it was pretty awesome. So maybe the next podcast will have a little slot just dedicated to. So I'm holding the beer in trust for my other Brothers Wisp members. It's diminishing, but it's actually, you know, there are five. I got 25 liter barrels of beer, and so it's like 10 pints in each one. So it's kind of
for like 25 days.
No, like it's for a party. So for the first party, we went through four of them, and it was scandalous. But so we're now down to we've consumed in this house six of them, and then I've given a couple to people who have done us favors and stuff like that. So just I was kind of woken up at 8:30, and you know, this truck backing up and the tail lift and bringing out a pallet, and I'm going, Bastion, do you order some? I don't know what's. And so it was kind of nice though from the guys in our fellowship. So I'll have to so guys, you can come to Ireland. I'm holding them in trust. There is a storage charge, which means that there's a residual drain on the beer, so you have to hook before it goes.
Interest is taken out of the cargo.
It was kind of cool because they definitely over delivered at that one.
That's cool. So I'm sure Mike had nothing to do with it.
That's not the first thing to show up at your house, though, is it?
No, the Trump. Although I have to say, marking the 100 days anniversary of Trump's presidency, I would say that the pallet of beer was very welcome.
Golly. All right. So Mike Hammett out of Chicago, hey. If people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way?
Billy's Whisk Facebook, I suppose. I mean, you can find me 1,000 ways, but I do that pretty well.
Okay, yeah. Mike is the keeper of the Brothers Whisk Facebook page. I think maybe 5 total posts have come from other people. Everything else is coming from him. So whenever you get those snappy responses, those comebacks, that's all Mike.
Mike trolling networks that are not peered with an IX.
On LinkedIn, yeah, I did that too. I made a post on LinkedIn a few weeks ago. I forget the exact word, but it was something like, if your network isn't done in IX, then it's not much of a network at all, now is it?
So can I ask you, is your network at home on an IX?
No.
There you go.
I'm nice. Hoping to have it there soon. But,
good times.
Not many get the deal that I get out of the data center that I'm at, so.
Fair enough.
A little bit of reason.
I hear you. All right, Miller, if people want to get a hold of you on the internet, how do they do that?
Dynastatic.net.
Do you still blog?
I haven't put something up there, but I was thinking about putting one up there for Run Deck and some of the other stuff that I've been working on, but I've been super busy.
Doing what?
Well, we just put up a Siklu 5 gigabit per second link. That took quite a while. Trying to do the outdoor fiber correctly. Getting the wrong stuff. Reordering stuff. Fusion splicing, that kind of stuff.
Cool.
That took us like a week to do. It's ridiculous. But hopefully the next one we do will go up a lot quicker. And then it rocks, by the way. And household stuff. Just bought a lawnmower today.
Point your fingers.
Yeah, that's when I used to do mowing in college, and I said as soon as I am occupationally able, I will never mow a lawn again. And I haven't mowed a lawn in about 5 years, and I love it.
We got a nice self-propelled one that moves as fast as you walk, kind of thing. And
don't care. Don't
it's
care.
Nice, but.
What about the robotic ones that kind of go around? They're solar powered.
The Robo-Yard dog thing? And now.
Kind of like having a sheep. It kind of keeps nibbling away.
All right. If you want to find me, Greg Soule, you can hit me on gregsoule.com. Catch me on LinkedIn. I occasionally blog, not nearly as much as I used to or ought to, and I was actually thinking about it last night, but I'm working on this Lynda course, and I think, well, I could do that, or I could do the thing that pays me, so I'll do the thing that pays me. Speaking of things that pay us, if you guys are sponsors or want to be sponsors, or have equipment and want somebody to try it out, give us a shout. I'm sure we can find somebody to take your stuff. Let's see what else. Any questions? So guys that aren't going to be able to show up to the MUM in May, if you have any routing questions, anything sort of MikroTik related that you'd like us to address in the panel, we need a little bit of fodder just in case people get shy. So we'll have a little bit of stuff kind of locked and loaded, some topics to talk about. Also, if more than one person asks us about the same thing, we know it's something we need to cover, so we'll make sure we will. Other than that, questions, comments, hit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. Or if you're old school, you can hit us at contactus@thebrotherswisp.com. If nothing else, I guess thank you guys for continually listening. If you are still awake, that is. Otherwise, thanks, and we will see you next time. I think we have one more before the MUM, and we'll keep pumping it out, keep pushing that brand. Thanks, guys.
See ya.